We're discussing the state of the pandemic in Wisconsin on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Governor Evers highlighted Wisconsin's vaccination effort yesterday in the state media briefing on the public health response.
Just this weekend, we were ranked second in the country and first in the Midwest for using available vaccine supply. That means we are using our available supply faster than any other state in the Midwest.
But Evers said we're not out of the woods yet as daily COVID cases continue to rise. What do you want to know about the status of vaccines, especially the J&J? Have you been able to get vaccinated? 800-642-1234. Dr. Ryan Westergaard is Chief Medical Officer and State Epidemiologist for Communicable Diseases for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Dr. Westergaard, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate, and thank you for the invitation to join you today.
So what is going on with this rising case count?
Well, it's probably a couple of things. The epidemiology of COVID-19 is changing with a pretty significant shift toward the new genetic variants. There's a subset of the virus that is circulating that is more highly transmissible, and we've seen this sort of spreading throughout the world, and it's now here in Wisconsin, a significant proportion. Probably over half of the cases that being detected are these more highly transmissible variants. So that's our best guess of what the leading cause is, but there's probably other things as well.
Okay, and so when you say these more contagious variants, is this specifically B.1.1.7 or other variants also emerging here?
Yes, the B.1.1.7, as you said, was the first one that was detected in December in the United Kingdom, and that is the largest share of the novel variants, but there are other ones as well. This is something that we watch closely by doing genome sequencing on a subset of the positive tests, and we're seeing it week by week increase. But right now, yes, B.1.1.7 is the predominant strain.
So there's quite a bit of surveillance going on of the tests that come back here in Wisconsin. Which age groups are testing positive for the virus? Do you see anything jump out there?
Yeah, there's been a significant shift in that as well. When you look at our big epidemic wave that occurred in November and December, it was older Wisconsin residents who were sort of leading the way. The age group that was the under 18 had the smallest proportion during that first fall and winter wave. It's completely flipped now. Right now, in the past several weeks, the age cohort, meaning the age group of people 18 and under, have the highest number of new infections. So it's really been a shift toward infections in younger people.
And that 20 to 29 age group as well, I'm seeing that really jump out.
Yeah, it's definitely been a shift. And I think it's probably two things. One is that we've focused on older folks for our early phases of vaccine administration. And it's without question true that we've prevented a lot of cases by vaccinating people. And for example, our 65 and older have had, you know, nearly 80% of the population has been vaccinated. So that's made a big difference. But there's also increased interaction, increased social gatherings among younger people. And as the weather gets nicer, as people are doing sports and activities outdoors, and I think that's playing a role as well.
What do you think about the impact of in-person schooling resuming, extracurricular activities?
Well, one of the things that we've learned, you know, pretty well over the past several months is that school can be done safely. In-person school can be done safely if we really pay attention to the multiple layers of prevention strategies. And that includes wearing masks, keeping social distance, and having small cohorts of students. When we do those things well, in-person school is safe. The absolute wrong thing to do right now would be to come back to school doing any of those things less. So I think that instruction in classrooms can be done safely, but we can't let our guard down. We have to continue to wear masks and enforce mask rules in school districts. And then if we do that, I think school itself will be safe. The other activities, as you mentioned, outside of school, sports, again, we need to have consistent mask wearing, social distancing. We can't let our guard down.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Ryan Westergaard, Chief Medical Officer for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, and we're looking at the situation with the pandemic now in Wisconsin. What do you see where you are? What's your reaction to our COVID cases rising? Are you surprised? Are you still seeing people who are social distancing and wearing masks? 800-642-1234. Dr. Westergaard, we have an email here from Saul in Stevens Point. Saul is concerned about the P1 variant from Brazil in Wisconsin. And does it represent a danger to unvaccinated people in Wisconsin and across the U.S.?
Yes, I think taken as a group, the novel variants in P1 and P2 are the frankly not very catchy names that we've given the variants that emerged in Brazil. They do pose a risk. They're all being studied actively, so we're learning more about them. In addition to being more highly transmissible, for example, for the B117, we do have some evidence that it causes more severe disease as well. So these are a more dangerous form of the virus. The good news is that the vaccines protect against these variants quite well. So getting vaccinated is a good way to prevent severe illness, even in the face of these new circulating strains.
Well, let's talk vaccines. Johnson & Johnson, the FDA and CDC telling states to hit pause there on the J&J vaccine to stop distributing it due to safety concerns. Wisconsin DHS has followed suit, pausing injections. Can you describe for us the concerns about this vaccine?
Yes, this was big news yesterday, and it's taking a lot of careful communication because it's a bit of a complex topic. The adverse event that was described in a small number of vaccine recipients of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is something called cerebral venous sinus thrombosis, which is a relatively rare type of blood clot that can cause stroke. And what was distinctive about this is that it also occurred in the setting of low platelets. And this raised the suspicion that it's a similar phenomenon, a similar type of rare adverse events that was seen in Europe with a similar vaccine, the adenovirus vector vaccine made by Oxford and AstraZeneca, that was in the news several months ago, also causing blood clots. So we think we are now detecting a new autoimmune phenomenon that occurs in a very small subset of people that can cause blood clots through this somewhat unique pathway. Now, the important thing to understand is that the pause of the vaccine is not because we think the vaccine is too dangerous to use. It's rather because we really need to fully understand this new illness, this new side effect, so we can educate the population about what is the risk with a fair level of precision, what they need to look for, and also let the whole medical community who's involved in administering vaccines and treatments to understand fully what this situation looks like and what how to counsel their patients. So we're optimistic that when we get through this next investigation, we will be armed with better knowledge about this adverse effect, but are cautiously optimistic that it's not going to limit the use of the vaccine. It's just appropriately we are collecting more information so we can give people the best advice about how to proceed safely with vaccination.
And here in Wisconsin, 160,000 doses of the J&J vaccine have been administered. If people have received this one, what should they be watching out for, or what should they do?
So what we've observed so far in people who have developed this complication is an illness that starts about between 5 days after receiving the vaccine and no more than 3 weeks after the vaccine. So it's a relatively early phenomenon. People who have received the vaccine more than a month ago really shouldn't worry about anything. And also, people that develop headache or flu-like symptoms on day one or two after the vaccine, which as many people know is very common, shouldn't also worry. The things to look for this rare and specific adverse event would be a severe headache that starts in that, you know, 1 week to 3 week period. Vision changes, sometimes abdominal pain and leg pain can be signs of blood clots as well. And this other aspect of the adverse event of low platelets, that can show up as very easy bruising, bleeding gums when you brush your teeth, or small spots called petechiae that can reflect, you know, small hemorrhages or bleeding in the skin. So those, again, very rare things, but people should know of what to look for if they have received the vaccine recently.
We're talking with state epidemiologist for communicable diseases. Ryan Westergaard is here as we discuss the state response to the pandemic, the concerns about the J&J vaccine, what's happening now with it. Have you stopped social distancing or wearing a mask? What is your reasoning? Is it because you're fully vaccinated? Do you have questions about COVID variants that are circulating? Join in your questions about COVID, 800-642-1234. Dr. Westergaard will be back with us in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show as we talk about the state response to the pandemic. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Are you fully vaccinated or on your way to that point? What do you want to know about COVID spread in Wisconsin? What do you want to know about mask wearing, other public health aspects of this pandemic? 800-642-1234. We have Dr. Ryan Westergaard, the top state health official for communicable diseases. He's with us for 10 more minutes. Dr. Westergaard, we heard from a teacher called in, couldn't stay with us. They wanted to know if students should be masked during outside recess. And the teacher says students at their school wear masks indoors, inside, but not outside. And students also don't social distance well outside at recess. What can you say there?
I think the risk of transmission in outdoor settings is lower. But if you are engaging in activities that bring you in close proximity to another person, the risk is not zero. So my suggestion would be that if kids are comfortable wearing masks inside, it's safer to keep masks on outside during outdoor activities as well. And that's just as the caller mentioned, because it's hard to maintain social distancing. So all of these things are, you know, pieces of the puzzle. There's not one thing that makes or breaks a safe environment. But my suggestion would be to wear masks as much as is practical in school settings, and that includes outside.
Let's go to Julie now from Beaver Dam with the question. Hi, Julie. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm in between shots, so I had my first shot from Pfizer March 30th, and my second shot is April 20th, and I caught a chest cold on top of all my allergies at this point.
And so you're wondering if you should be cleared and go ahead with that second dose? Is that the question?
Yeah, or is the chest cold part of, like, the side effects of the Pfizer?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the side effects of the vaccine can be what we call flu-like, meaning those body aches and the headache that you can get when you have the flu. But they're typically not the respiratory symptoms, the sore throat, the cough, the runny nose, for example. So there's a couple of possibilities. One is, you know, there's a lot of causes for those things. There can be other viruses that are going around. And it's also true that the vaccines aren't fully protective, particularly when you haven't completed the full dose. So it might be reasonable to get a COVID test and see your provider to see if there's any other testing that's appropriate. Having mild illness, though, isn't a contraindication to getting the first or second dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. So shouldn't necessarily delay, but particularly if you've been around other sick people, wouldn't be a bad idea to go ahead and get tested for COVID, because it is possible to still get infected after the first dose.
You know, this is such a race against time with this virus, and we're, you know, nowhere near herd immunity when the virus can no longer spread easily through our communities. What must be done to level off this rising case count we're seeing?
Yeah, it's the things that we've been doing all along. And I think if we would have had to put our energy in one place, it would be for the idea of sustaining our effort. I think the easy thing to do now, you know, a year plus, year and a half into the epidemic, is to just get so sick and tired of this pandemic that we stop doing the things that we've grown accustomed to doing. And mask wearing in public is probably most common among us that I'm hearing. People are saying, well, we're close enough. Can we stop wearing masks? I think that's a mistake at this point, both because, as you said, we're not out of it. We don't have enough people protected from because of vaccination in the community, and these new, more contagious variants are spreading. So as much as we hate to be in this situation, there is still a risk of severe illness for a lot of people. And only by collectively all doing our part, all wearing masks, all continuing the social distancing, can we keep transmission low. In addition to that, which we've been doing all along, participating, having good conversations, talking about our vaccine experience with friends and neighbors who might be considering or hesitant to get the vaccine. These are the things we've got, since more tools than we've ever had to prevent disease. We just need to, keep at it, keep the energy level sustained so we can get through this, because it's not over yet, unfortunately.
We're talking with Dr. Ryan Westergaard, infectious disease physician, chief medical officer for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Ricky is now joining us in Oconomowoc. Hi, Ricky.
Hi. Yeah, my question is about surveillance in general. It seems that there's a heightened sensitivity to the J&J AstraZeneca, but what about Moderna and Pfizer and what the CDC is doing in terms of surveillance of all of the vaccines?
You mean by way of monitoring side effects after
Correct.
Administering them? Okay.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. That's a really important question. And in a lot of conversations we've had over the past 24 hours, the idea has come up quite a bit that this pause, this recognition of this really rare event is a good evidence that the system is working. So what is that system? And we have multiple overlapping systems to detect potential adverse events that occur after vaccination. And the most common one that's been used for a long time is called VAERS, V-A-E-R-S, the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. So all providers that administer vaccines are trained to report any vaccine adverse events that they hear about into this system. So that's, all the many millions of vaccines that are given are given by a provider who's been trained and expected to add these things to the system. In addition to that, with COVID-19 vaccine, everyone who gets a vaccine has the opportunity to download a smartphone app and contribute data every day or every week about any symptoms that they're having. So this is an active form of surveillance that's really using the whole population able to be participating in reporting adverse events. And then there's a big team of analysts and experts at CDC poring over the data to see, are we experiencing anything, any level of adverse events that's higher than what we expect in the general population just due to chance. So that was exactly how this really small number of severe adverse events was detected and led to the current situation where we're looking more closely for this. So it's a good question.
As this vaccination, as these vaccinations get approved for younger and younger people, is the state putting together a plan for how children will get vaccinated once they're available?
Yes, and it's going to look very similar to the current strategy. We've at DHS have been working hard to engage as many possible providers of vaccine or vaccine administrators, including healthcare providers and non-traditional providers in health departments and fire departments and county health departments and schools eventually might be on this list. So we're thinking logistically how to make vaccine available in more and including non-traditional places to get vaccine. Because as you mentioned earlier, Kate, it's a bit of a race against time and against the variants. Once we hear that the vaccines are authorized for use in younger people, we want to get the vaccine out into arms as quickly as we can. And we've built a good infrastructure to do that so far. And we just need to keep building it and keep extending our reach to provide vaccines in all corners of the state among all eligible populations.
So what I'm hearing here is that, maybe the pediatrician's office would be certainly one place, a starting place, but you're, really thinking much more broadly about this.
I think so. Vaccine, primary care offices have been the mainstay and are a really important partner for giving all vaccines, and that'll continue to be true for COVID vaccines. But this is a very rare, severe, once-in-our-lifetime type of pandemic. So we really are taking an all-hands-on-deck approach, engaging different partners who can give vaccines in other areas, trying to make it as accessible and as easy to administer as possible. And that's required a great deal of work, but we're making good progress.
Circling back once again to vaccine rollout here in Wisconsin, you know, the pausing of the J&J, will that affect our ability to get shots into arms with our supply?
To some degree, but not to a large degree, I would say. The two messenger RNA vaccines, that's the Pfizer and the Moderna, are still representing the lion's share of our vaccines administered, and supply continues to be good for both of those. So there's a lot of places, a lot of venues across the state that have the two Pfizer and Moderna vaccines in good supply, and the supply will continue to be coming in. So I think this is a setback, but as I mentioned, I think we should look at this as an opportunity of the system working right, making sure we understand all the risks before we administer vaccines widely. But we still have good access to the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, and it's also important to note that there's been no occurrence of this blood clotting disorder in those two vaccines. So we don't have any reason to suspect that risk carries to the other one. So people should feel confident getting those other vaccines.
Dr. Westergaard, thank you for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Have a great day.
You too. Infectious disease physician Ryan Westergaard, Chief Medical Officer for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services and an Associate Professor in the Department of Medicine in the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. News update is next here on the Ideas Network.